tonight on Arena. Eurovision, Irresistible and Finally Lie Delivered are the movies up for review. Social media sensation Morgan Bullock on her new piece for Dancer from the Dance. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. We kick off tonight with the latest digital film releases. Will Ferrell and Rachel McAdams bring us Eurovision, the story of an Icelandic entry to the famous song contest. Steve Carell and Rose Byrne are playing politics in Jon Stewart's new film Irresistible. And Maxine Peake transports us to Cromwellian England in Fanny Lie Delivered. John McGuire and Angela Flannery have been watching the three movies, and John is with me in studio here. Angela's joining us down the line. We'll kick off with the crowd pleaser here, Eurovision. Iceland seemingly have a pretty bad reputation in the Eurovision Song Contest.
Do they?
Yeah, well,
I know nothing about it.
Well, that's kind of the basis of this movie, isn't it?
That's the whole idea. Do you remember an urban myth years ago that did the rounds here about how Ireland sent a dud act to the Eurovision on purpose so that we'd lose and avoid having to pay the massive cost of hosing it again? Now, I can't recall if the plan worked or if it backfired spectacularly, but in any event, Will Ferrell has taken the bones of that obviously totally never happened thing and made a comedy out of it, set, like you say, in Iceland. There's no Eurovision this year. It's cancelled for the first time since 1956, which is a remarkable record. Yeah. So fans are going to have to make do with what Ferrell can come up with here. He plays Lars, a clueless Icelandic singer who, together with his childhood friend Sigrid, played by Rachel McAdams, has harboured this dream to represent their island nation on the international stage. And they enter the national competition, things go awry, they get to the final in glamorous Glasgow, and so on.
Yeah, Edinburgh, I think they go to, actually, isn't it?
Is it Edinburgh?
Yeah, I think it's Edinburgh.
Oh, it is Edinburgh, you're right, not glamorous Edinburgh. Glasgow. It is Edinburgh, the rock, the castle,
yeah,
etc.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, it's Edinburgh that they go to. So, Angela, then, you know, it's the Eurovision Song Contest itself, you could parody it till the cows come home, but it's interesting what Will Ferrell does here in terms of the nature of how he presents the Eurovision Song Contest.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, you know, we can say this is a parody, but, you know, this film is a lot more than that. It's a musical comedy, and I kind of saw it as a tribute, almost a mockumentary, but definitely a tribute. I mean, John is there saying, well, I know nothing about that. I don't know a whole lot about it, but I can appreciate the spectacle of Eurovision. Yeah. Not one of these people who watches it all the time, but a lot of people do. And there is just this whole circus around it and the voting and the geopolitics. And it is kind of exciting. And for the, you know, the week that it's on, it dominates the airwaves, radio, you know, we're talking about it. And Ireland, of course, has skin in the game because during our glory days, we won four in a row. There's five in the 90s that we won, you know, and we just can't get back up there. Right. So, I mean, there will be a lot of interest in this, I think, here. But yeah, you're right. His approach to it is quite different. I think that Ferrell came across it in Sweden. I believe his wife is Swedish. And of course, he's American. Right. So what do the Americans know about it? And that's where he came across it, thought, wow, what a great idea. And then actually went to the Eurovision in Lisbon a couple of years later and did a recce.
Right. Figure out... What I want to do to give a sense of, because, yeah, as I say, pastiche would be easy here, but he manages to just, in my mind anyway, tread the line between, you know, totally making fun of it and presenting it very close to what it might be. Dan Stevens, yes, cousin Matthew from Downton Abbey, is a Russian singer in the song contest that we're presented with in the film. And here he is singing his entry.
It's a jungle out there, so hold on tight.
Lars, that voice! It's incredible!
The Russian, Alexander Lemtov. He's one of the favourites.
Oh yes, I can see why.
And on and on and on and on. Let's get together. I'm a lion lover and I hunt for love. On the savannah, I will make you rise up to the sky above. And when I woo, you know I'm done.
So he's very good, but Sigrid, no one has a more perfect voice than you.
Lion of love. Lion of love.
There go.
Dan Stevens. You know, I know
going,
that,
wouldn't it?
It certainly would. Yeah. I know that Rachel McAdams, that there's a voiceover artist for her. Was that Dan Stevens singing? Do we know that?
I presume so, because the only credited singer that isn't on screen is Molly Sandén, who's a Swedish singer who dubs the voice for Rachel McAdams. And has a standout moment close to the end where she sings this song called Hometown, which just sounds like a Eurovision song and will raise the hairs on the back of your head. Yeah. It's a really lovely song. But there's a lot of what goes before. It might be affectionate and they might, you know, really love the Eurovision and want to celebrate it. But some of it is pretty weak and there aren't an awful lot of jokes. Where you expect a joke to be, there isn't one.
I think
that's a bit that's a major downfall in the first hour anyway.
Yeah, part of the problem is exactly that, I think, Angela. The opening section of the film, there's an awful lot of setting up done in and around the Icelandic TV, public service TV station, and how they don't want to get to win the final at all, in case they have to host the contest at some point further on and their economics are messed up. Could we just dispense with that and get on with it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that I think they make a couple of points lightly there. I mean, this is an intelligent film. They have references to the European banking crisis, and the villain of the piece is actually the head of the Icelandic Central Bank. And, you know, I mean, to be honest, Molly Sandén has entered the Eurovision three times and represented Sweden. I think people, you know, who know Eurovision will look at this and really, really enjoy it. It is as spectacular and impressive a production as Eurovision itself. There's no less than 10 Eurovision finalists in this, real ones, you know, that people will recognize. I mean, do you remember Lordi, that crazy Finnish metal band that had those orc suits on? They're in it. And then there's the Austrian Conchita Wurst, complete with ball gown and beard. She's in it. The Israeli winner Netta from 2018 is in it. I mean, this is an all-star cast. Demi Lovato is in it. The singing, the spectacle, the whole lot is great. I mean, respectfully, I disagree. I thought this did exactly what it set out to do. And I really enjoyed Will Ferrell in it. I thought he was right back in Buddy the Elf territory. You know, it was the eternally optimistic kind of, you know, guy who's just I suppose a middle-aged man child looking for the affection of very cold father, who's the most handsome man in Iceland.
Pierce Brosnan, very much the handsome older father in this particular case. Although Pierce Brosnan playing Will Ferrell's father seems a little bit odd. We'll hear the dynamic between the two of them in this clip now.
The bank called. I can no longer afford the house and my fishing boat. I must choose.
By the boat, so many fond memories.
I make money fishing. I'm selling the house.
But I live there with you.
You're a middle-aged man, Lars. It's time for you to start living your life. Time to move on from your childish dreams. Be the man your mother wanted you to be.
She loved having me around the house, so she might not be happy.
You know, and normally I'd be given out about people putting on European accents of any kind, but it kind of suits this in the nature of the whole piece. That's Pierce Brosnan and Will Ferrell there in his clip from Eurovision. And John McGuire here in studio with me. There is the other side. There is that father-son story, but there's also just the simple love story between Rachel McAdams' character and Will Ferrell's character. And you look, it's a comedy. They're going to get together. I'm not giving anything away.
Eventually they're going to get together. But it's kind of Lars is a kind of a best of Will Ferrell compilation character, really. He has all of those familiar routines that Ferrell has done over the years. Overly tight costumes, obliviousness to the adoration of a beautiful woman, awkwardness in social situations. He's very much playing to his strengths, but he's not really exerting himself. I found Rachel McAdams to be the much more interesting character. She's smart, she's talented, she's good-hearted. She believes in elves, like a lot of Icelandic people do. And there's a very funny sequence where the elves come into play. And she believes in herself more important than the elves. And she keeps the film grounded as much as she can while your man is acting the goon around her. But it's her route through the story I found the more interesting than Ferrell's.
Just before we get your stars, let's have a listen to that great clip. Who did you say again, Angela, is the singer that's voicing the Rachel McAdams role here, Rachel McAdams' role?
Molly Sandén.
Say again?
Molly Sandén.
Okay, well, let's have a listen to Volcano Man song.
Woke up at night, I heard floating coal. They guided me.
Okay, that could win the Eurovision. Molly Sandon singing there, the Volcano Man song, which has a little bit of the Icelandic language in it too, which makes the entire village cry and made me have a lump in my throat too. Now, I was totally suckered by this one. John, I don't think you were as much. Stars?
I've seen Ferrell be funnier. I've seen the Eurovision more cleverly and lampooned. Yes, there's affection here, but I would say 3 stars. It's worth it watching. And like I say, there's no Eurovision this year, so what are you going to do if you want that?
Yeah, which might explain why the film's too long, like the voting in the Eurovision. And from you, Angela?
Well, I'm going to have to disagree that it's a lampooning job. Proof that it's not is Graham Norton actually is in it as himself, the BBC commentator. So how would he lampoon his own job? Not possible. It was an absolute tonic. I thought I wouldn't like it. I sat down with my almost 13-year-old son, warning it's for 15s. It's got schoolboyish humour in it. Mm. He fell around the place laughing and we had a great time watching it. 4 out of 5.
4 out of 5 of you. I'm kind of with you on that one, I have to say, Angela. And actually, at the end of it as well, flags come up for the nationalities of different people involved. We won't say what flag comes up for Graham Norton.
Irish
we won't
say
what...
Up.
Yeah, don't tell them. And what flag comes up for Pierce Brosnan. You'll wait and see what the two of them do. Very interesting choices of flags on their part. Right, let's move on then to Irresistible from actor and comedian turned filmmaker John Stewart. John Stewart, I suppose The Daily Show is what most people will remember him for, John McGuire.
That's right. He presented the show between 1999 and 2015, and it became a pop culture phenomenon and a beacon for American liberals by skewering the arrogance and the venality of American political leaders and their celebrities. Everybody watched it, and it made stars of a lot of Stewart's contributors, including Steve Carell, who stars in this movie. But people like Stephen Colbert, Trevor Noah, Samantha Bee, all the American, what you call liberal, what the Americans call liberal, commentators and comedians came out of The Daily Show. It was a massive show for him. He left it in 2015, just before Trump came to power. And I think he's been kind of bitter ever since that he's not on air during this time when, you know, it's made for him, the times we live in.
And in fact, John mentions there, Angela, this idea that he came off air just before Trump came to power. In fact, this film is set or starts the day after Trump came to power.
Yeah, it opens in the morning after the results of the 2016 presidential election. And that's where we meet Steve Carell, who is playing Gary Zimmer, who's the chief political strategist for the Democrats. And, you know, this is obviously his worst nightmare. And now he has to go forward. And how is he going to resurrect his team of spin doctors and indeed the Democratic Party? And so he comes across a YouTube video of... a farmer in rural Wisconsin, a widower, and a retired military man called Colonel Jack Hastings. And in this video, Colonel Jack is giving a very impassioned speech in favor of migrant workers' rights at a town hall meeting. And Gary Zimmer has this idea that, well, you know, this guy could save the Democratic Party, that really, you know, while he may look politically red, that beneath his flak jacket, there's a blue Democrat heart beating. And this is what the Democrats need to appeal to the common man and, you know, in swing states. So he decides to go out to Wisconsin and to recruit a fairly reluctant Jack Hastings to run as mayor of the town of Deerlaken.
Right. OK, we'll come back to, and this is Chris Cooper that plays that character. We'll come back to that character in a moment. But I want to get a sense of what they think are... what comes is set up here as this type of political satire, very early seen in the film, in fact. And Carell is coming in to give out to a group of his team about how they went about things during the election.
Hey, everybody. Hard at work, I see. That's good. That's good. I had a couple of questions. What tactical genius in here thought it might be a good idea to carpet bomb a particular neighborhood in this town with flyers suggesting that Colonel Jack Hastings would make sure that contraception is paid for by the government?
I did. Oh. The data showed an unusually concentrated grouping of single women in the area who were deeply interested in reproductive rights.
And you know why that is?
Well, why is not really
because this concentrated grouping of single women, as you put it, is a convent. They are nuns, which is how many of them are going to end up voting for us. Nuns of them.
That's really lame. Steve Carell there in a scene from Irresistible. Is that the level of satirical humour, John?
It's not, it doesn't really get much beyond that. Stewart has a lot of things to say. It's just that he's quite clumsy in how he says them. And the weft and weave of this film is really just pot shots at either side, while Carell's character, Gary Zimmer, stands in the middle. The great catch in the film is once he gets to Deer Lakin in Wisconsin, Colonel Hastings and his daughter, who's played by Mackenzie Davis, make sure that he can't pass this job on to a flunky. He has to stay in the town. So it's like Doc Hollywood, if you remember that Michael J. Fox film, Doc Hollywood, but for politics. And the complications that he tries to bring to it, where he tries to create this media storm. The Republicans arrive in the form of Rose Byrne. They start spending money all over the place on TV ads and expensive billboards, and he has to follow suit. And this battle that's in this town of a couple of hundred people is supposed to illustrate the wider battle that's at play in the media and money and campaign financing and that kind of thing in the US. All perfectly good, perfectly valid areas of exploration for comedy and for politics, but it's a little underpowered and a little it's weak, and it gets weaker when it should get stronger.
Let's listen to Carell again then, and here he is strategizing Michelle Obama style with his candidate's daughter Diana, played by Mackenzie Davis.
We can't win unless it turns out that this town isn't the Mayberry everybody thinks it is.
We're the good guys, right?
Yeah, we're the good guys.
When they go low,
we go high.
Unless we also need to go low, apparently.
Only to keep those who would go lower out of power.
So when they go low, we go higher incrementally in relation to how low they went.
Regrettably, yes.
When they go low, we go almost as low, but we feel worse doing it.
And that's Mackenzie Davis playing the character of Diana. That's the Colonel's daughter in a clip from Irresistible. And you also heard Steve Carell. Again, it seems to overplay all of the wordiness in that for me. Angela, did it work for you?
No, this film really didn't work for me at all. I mean, not only was it not very funny, I think there were maybe twice I sort of cracked a smile, once at the very beginning where there's a cringe-worthy scene with Deborah Messing, who then just disappears for no reason. He could have used her. She's a great comedic actress. And then there's a joke about a semicolon, which is so nerdy. I'm probably one of a handful of people who would get it. And that was it. But really why it didn't work for me is that it was very flabby. It wasn't at all politically astute. The way that, you know, that John Stewart, what we would have expected from him. And I think where John is saying, you know, that Stewart finished on The Daily Show, I think it might have actually been 2016, but, you know, around the time on the presidential election, which means what has he been doing in the meantime? You know, as a writer of political satire, he would have been on the top of his game really quick. He would have been match fit back then. Right now, he isn't. You know, it felt like a film from 4 years ago. It was really dated and actually kind of distasteful. Real life events have overtaken what's going on in this film. And like race in particular was something that, you know, there was a line in there about, you know, he's trying to shift around the background for a video they're making. And obviously it's on the farm, on Colonel Jack's farm, and they've got the cows a certain way. And he comes out with this line, there's too many black cows in the background of that video. They're all in the cluster. Will you move them? He's supposed to be a moderate. Now, that does not work today.
Yeah. So that it stars then. I think this is going to be it was a big disappointment, I think, to you, essentially, Angela, and stars.
Two and a half.
Two and a half from you. And John, what
do you
say?
I think he redeems it slightly in the last 20 minutes when he sharpens his knife against, and particularly over the closing credits, there's a very interesting development. I'm not going to reveal it, but there's a very interesting development over there. And he just about redeems it, but it's a very close run thing. I mean, this is not top quality stuff at all.
All right. So stars from you. What did you say, John?
Three.
Not much
generously.
Joy from either of you there, really, in terms of Irresistible. Let's finish up then with Fanny Lai, delivered, written and directed by Thomas Clay. In fact, I spoke with Maxine Peake about this film earlier in the week. I would describe it, I suppose, Angela, as a kind of a Western set in puritanical post-Civil War England. Fairly unforgiving place, particularly for women, it has to be said.
Yeah, you know, it's great that you describe it as a Western, because that's what I thought watching it. But I'd seen it billed as a folk horror, which kind of made me think, am I going to enjoy this in historical drama? And intriguingly, given the period, the mid-1600s, a home invasion thriller, such a thing actually possible at that time. But yeah, it really had that kind of quality of a spaghetti Western. You know, I mean, just really kind of heavy atmosphere and a lot of smoke and mist and those close-up eye shots as well of, over the peak of the cap and stuff. So there was that sensibility, a lot of Spanish guitar in it. But yeah, aside from that, this is, a feminist film is how it's being built. And certainly, you know, feminism back then, I'm not even comfortable calling it that, but it's a film about women's emancipation because the character in this, the title character, Fanny Lai, is, I mean, really enslaved to her husband, and that is a sign of the times. During the Cromwellian period, she's got a puritanical husband, John Lai, who's played by Charles Dance, who people will know from Game of Thrones. And so basically they're on their Shropshire farm when two naked strangers take refuge in it and they come across them. They are played by Freddie Fox and by Tanya Reynolds, Thomas and Rebecca. And
They arrive into the film naked, which you're not expecting in Cromwellian England, that anybody who was found naked would be thrown into the pond immediately. You would have expected. How does the film look, John, when you consider that we're in this puritanical place, this puritanical society, and lots of little sects involved here as well? But essentially, was it what you expected from that very harsh England of the 17th century?
Not really, no. Like Angela said, the spaghetti Western influences are very obvious. There's folk, I think the folk horror is there, elements of it, and the home invasion thriller tropes that we've become familiar with are all there, present and correct. But he's made the clay, who's a bit of a maverick and very much an outsider in the British film industry, has made the film in the style of the 1970s films made in the same era, the puritanical Cromwellian era, such as Kevin Brownlow's Win Stanley from 75, or Michael Reeves' Witchfinder General in particular from a couple of years earlier, with which I think the film has quite a bit in common. And once the two strangers have arrived in the home and these ex-soldier played by Charles Dance kind of reluctantly allows them to stay, sometime later, Peter MacDonald arrives into the film as the High Sheriff, as a dandy, dandified High Sheriff. And MacDonald seems to be loving every minute of this, and he gets the tone of Clay's intention absolutely correct, I think. It's almost a surreal take on real and genuine history. And Clay is extremely good at building the world. He built these sets, he built the house, he built the farm. It feels very real and very lived in. And at the same time, there's this heightened sensibility that MacDonald and a few of the other characters bring to it, where it's not real. It edges towards that kind of folk horror and into the realm of the unreal.
Let's listen to a scene between Freddie Fox playing the character of Thomas Ashby, who's the young fellow part of the couple who arrives into the scene. And here he is with Maxine Peake as Fanny Lai, and the subject is her husband's Bible.
What are you doing with my husband's Bible?
This book interests you greatly, doesn't it?
No. I mean, scripture ain't for a woman to touch.
Pious nonsense. See? What says that?
Well, I don't know.
J-O-H-N. John. It's your husband's name. And that?
That says John as well.
Right. See? That's so difficult, isn't it?
You're wasting your time, Mr. Ashby. I'm far too set in my ways.
You are as you feel yourself to be. I see you have mead.
We do. For special occasion.
There we go. Fanny Lai, played by Maxine Peake, and the character of Thomas Ashby, played by Freddie Fox. Freddie Fox, who incidentally was also in Black 47, and as was quite rightly just pointed out to me, Black 47 was a famine western, and here we are in a Cromwellian western, if you like. But Angela, essentially that relationship, and the relationship with Rebecca, who's the young woman who arrives into the household with Thomas, that triangle is at the heart of the film.
Yeah, it is. They're on a mission to convert Fanny to their way of thinking. And, she is somebody who, because she's played so well, actually, to be fair to Maxine Peake, she's very silent, but you can see there's a hidden intelligence and intensity, a resourcefulness that, she's a woman who knows there's a world beyond this tiny existence, and they're playing on that. And so what they're trying to sell her, you know, as, you know, this sect of, you know, radical sect with libertine values, is her, you know, to rebel and, you know, her sexual liberation. And, you know, will she go for it? But of course, she's putting herself and her family in great danger because they're harboring these fugitives who are heretics who've broken the law and fornicators, and Peter MacDonald is after them. I found it really, really interesting. I just didn't find the casting or the characters in the Rebecca and Thomas that convincing, because Maxine Peake plays Fanny Lai, an intelligent woman, and she just came. I just didn't believe that that character could be so easily won over by Thomas's rhetoric and his bawdiness and his lusty behaviour. You know, it's an uncomfortable film to watch. It's violent. There's sexual coercion in it. It's a very interesting film. And I really, really think that it's carried completely by Maxine Peake's performance.
Stars from you, Angela?
Four.
Four from you. Yeah, there was something about this, John, when I was watching, I thought there was loads of this that's not working. But somehow when I got to the end of the film, I thought that was very interesting. And I wasn't quite sure how I had the two things running alongside each other.
It's Maxine Peake's performance you responded to, I think. Like Angela says, she's fierce, she's strong, she's intelligent, she holds the film together. It's a very convincing depiction of a woman surviving in a world deeply hostile to women, to children and to the vulnerable. But there are issues with this film. Clay, like being the maverick, he's done everything. He wrote it, he produced it, he directed it, he did the score, he was involved in composing the music. The list of influences and the pastiche that he's bringing to it is also in collision with this three-way story that he has going on. There's a lot to unpack. I don't think the film can carry all the weight that he puts on it, although Maxine Peake does her absolute best on it. I didn't like it as much as Angela did. I would give it 3 stars. It's certainly worth investigation, but be warned, like Angela said, it is violent. There is a lot of sexual content in it that some people might find disturbing. But if you know what you're getting into, you might very well get something out of it.
That's John McGuire and Angela Flannery speaking to us finally there about Fanny Lai Delivered and the other two films we spoke about this evening, Irresistible and Eurovision. And 27 minutes to 8 on Thursday night's Arena. Dancer from the Dance 2020 Festival of Irish Choreography is a 5-day online festival curated by John Scott from Irish Modern Dance Theatre. It starts next Monday. The 32 choreographers taking part include our own Junk Ensemble and David Bulger, plus artists with roots in the US, Barbados and Nigeria. 22 of them are bringing new work to our screens in locations ranging from the great outdoors to their own homes, reflecting changes that the pandemic has brought to dance, not an art form usually associated with the idea of physical distancing, for sure. John Scott is with me now in studio, and Morgan Bullock joined us on the line from Virginia in the US. Morgan is bringing a new piece to the festival, and we'll speak to her about that shortly. But John, this time last year, I know you were in and you were getting ready for this festival as well, and there we were, you were talking about this, you know, a call to arms really for Irish dance, challenging a whole range of outdated ideas around identity. It's a whole different challenge this year with the pandemic and distancing.
Indeed, Sean. The thing that made me start Dancer from the Dance Festival originally was a conversation I had with a presenter in New York, Catherine Tharin, in the 92nd Street Y in 2017. We were performing there. And she said, so what's happening in Ireland? What is Irish dance? And she wanted to know. And I started telling her about all the different things. And she proposed that maybe I curate an Irish dance festival of Irish choreographers to perform in New York. So we partnered with Irish Arts Centre. We had our first festival last year. It's a festival that happens uniquely both in New York and in Dublin. So we were physically in New York, brought over. We had, I think, 13 choreographers. Una Doherty from Belfast. Muftar Youssef from Nigeria via Trim. And a lot of different choreographers who identify as Irish. And Irish-American choreographers like Sean Curran, Derek Carr, Jean Butler. This year, we were all set. Dublin getting ready to go into project next week. The pandemic hit. First, we held on, maybe they'll open, maybe it's going to lift. Then it didn't. And I thought, how are we going to do this? Because there's been a lot of stuff online. Some has been amazing. Some of it has been less than interesting. And you're looking at people dancing with their bookshelves or having Zoom meetings or whatever in living rooms.
And you end up watching the bookshelf.
Exactly. And you're fantasizing about what are those books? What's that thing? I think I've read that book there and everything. And I performed in April for a theatre in New York, La Mama, in a cabaret they call Café La Mama, and they had extracts of different pieces by artists, myself, Yoshiko Chuma, the poet Dale Orlando Smith, and I performed a five-minute excerpt from my solo Heroes in my hallway, but we worked performing very low-tech into my laptop screen. And it was actually really thrilling. And it felt like this is something valid. It's not a dance film. It's a live performance, but it's being picked up by a smartphone. So I thought, we can do it this way. I Zoomed and talked with all the different choreographers we had lined up. Everyone said, yes, let's do it. So everyone is making pieces in strange locations, in front of a waterfall, a park. One of them's on a beach. We've got these incredible locations. Morgan has made a piece in this empty amphitheater in Virginia. So we've got a whole lot of different locations, and it's a response by artists to a new way of making work.
Well, let's ask Morgan specifically. First of all, Morgan, about that location, an amphitheater in Virginia. It sounds a very exciting location. Where is it? What is it? How did you choose it?
The theater that I chose to record my piece in is actually an outdoor theater that I practice at pretty often now, especially with the pandemic and everything. I've been practicing there at the outdoor stage, and it is like a really nice stage that does have like theater seating, but of course there is no one out there. So yeah, I just chose it as a nice location where I have space to dance.
I'll come back to the piece that you're making in that space in the moment, but just to give people a sense of what has been going on in your own life, particularly since last May, when your video, a video that you made that Beyoncé's mum, among others, reposted online, which combines Irish dancing with rap music. Now, what's your connection with Irish dance, and how did you put it together with rap?
Well, I've been Irish dancing for 11 years now. I started it when I was 10 years old. I just saw it for the first time, fell in love, and ever since I've just been Irish dancing. And when this song was, when the song came out that I did the video to, a lot of people were uploading videos of themselves on TikTok and like other social media of them just dancing to the song, but they were doing more like hip hop type of dancing, and that's just not something that I'm trained in. So I just decided to upload a video of me Irish dancing to it. I heard the song and I was like, I can accompany these beats with my shoes, I feel like. So I just did it for fun, uploaded the video, and it got so much more attention than I thought it would. It was just something I did for fun to a song that I liked to listen to.
Yeah, and you say that you started Irish dancing 11 years ago. But how big a thing is Irish dance in Richmond, Virginia, where you grew up?
It's something that the dance community, I guess, knows a little bit about. I was lucky enough to dance for a studio that offered Irish dance classes, and that's how I came to find out about Irish dance. But I started off with just ballet and tap, and you know, the basic things that dancers start off with in America. And yeah, I just saw Irish dancing and it was amazing. I don't think that it's something that most people here in Richmond know a lot about, but it was just something that caught my eye immediately.
I know when we talk about Irish dance here, are we essentially speaking, which was how important was river dance, for example, in your exposition to Irish dance?
It was very important. Just as a beginner, looking up videos of Irish dance on YouTube or whatever, I would watch the original Eurovision performance of Riverdance over and over and over. And I actually danced for a dance school where my instructors all performed with Riverdance and toured with Riverdance. So, it had a huge influence on, I guess, any Irish dancer. I'm no exception to that.
Well, just one further question on that piece before I ask you about your current piece, which is, I think some people criticised you around the video, that accusations of cultural misappropriation. How did you respond to that, or how do you respond to that?
It was a shock, honestly, getting comments like that, because I had never been accused of appropriating culture. Like I said, I've been Irish dancing for 11 years, and it's not anything that anyone has ever said before and recently. Mm. My response to that was just, I kind of used it as a teaching moment, because another one of my passions is teaching and educating. And I feel like people are quick to use the term cultural appropriation or misappropriation and don't really know what the term actually means. And I mean, as far as Irish dance, there's Irish dance in Mexico, China, Africa, it's all over the world. And I think that Irish dance is just so beautiful, and dancing in general is any kind of cultural dance. I think culture is something that should be shared. And my response to it is just, if you look at a video of a black girl Irish dancing, and your first instinct is to say that that's cultural appropriation or cultural misappropriation, you either don't know what the term means, you don't know a lot about Irish dance, or both.
Okay, fair enough. Tell me a little bit then about the piece that you are making for the festival, which is called Tall and Straight, My Mother Taught Me.
Yeah, the piece is titled from, of course, a reference to Riverdance. And it's just about my journey as a dancer, starting off very shy and timid as a little girl doing ballet and tap, just kind of doing things that I wasn't really comfortable doing, until I started Irish dancing, and it came naturally to me. It felt natural, Irish dancing, compared to anything else I had done before. And the piece really just encompasses that, and it shows how I've grown more confident as an Irish dancer throughout the years.
And it takes place then in that amphitheater. Have you seen a version of it yet, John? John Scott in the studio with me.
Yes, I have. Morgan sent it to me, and it's joyous. It's fun. It's kind of different. I think, Morgan, you'd agree it's different from some of the stuff you've put up on TikTok. It gives a whole picture. And I feel really, you know, Morgan and I met, I saw her post on Twitter, and I heard her interview with Amida Bowery. And we made contact, and we've known each other really just since May. But I feel I've got to know a whole load more about Morgan from this piece. It's got all her virtuosity, but it's also very personal.
Yeah, and Tall and Straight, My Mother Taught Me. It's not just, I suppose, in some ways, it's a physical direction from your mother. Stand up straight like a good girl, I'm sure she said to you more than once or twice. But it also has a kind of a moral force behind it. How does it speak to you in that respect? I suppose in light of Black Lives Matter and what's happening at the moment, does that feed into the piece that you've made?
I think it does. I think it feeds into the way that I move now and how I'm choreographing, just kind of letting myself go and being expressive in that way. I think the title mostly I chose to focus on the teaching part, like, because it's about my journey as a dancer, it's kind of like, while I'm referencing something that I heard, like, Tall and Straight, My Mother Taught Me, This Is How We Dance, the song from Riverdance and the poem, it's kind of like paying respect to that, just Irish dance in general, but then also just, you know, the external things, like, being taught to be confident and all of that.
I'll ask John, I'll give the final question to John, and in 10, 15 seconds, John, you have to tell me about your own piece, which is called Me. It must be, I presume, be about yourself.
Me, well, it's a kind of a code to dancers, Basia Pembele Kamalandua and Connor Thomas Doherty, dancing, socially distancing, wearing masks in a park. And they have this kind of duet where they're kind of almost running and sparring with each other, and they're dancing. It was very strange when we went to make it, and we were wearing masks. We know each other intimately, but it's a new scene. And I think what Emma said about the Irishness, what is Irishness? And it's part of this grab the Irish imagination and what Morgan is doing in the US, what we're doing, what all the different choreographers of places are doing is part of why we have the festival.
That's John Scott there and Morgan Bullock speaking to me about Dancer from the Dance 2020 Festival of Irish Choreography. It will be streamed on Facebook Live and on YouTube from the 29th of June through until the 3rd of July. Full details on irishmoderndancetheatre.com. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. All I know is what I hold in my own two hands. If it's out there, I'm gonna find it. Oh, am I strong enough? Oh, am I strong enough? Strong enough, the title of the song there from Frere LaMontagne, and that from his new album Monovision, which will be one of the three we're reviewing on Friday night's programme. That's tomorrow night. Yes, it is. The other two from, or the one from Jesse Ware and one from Haim, bringing us to 12 minutes to 8 in time now for Where Do I Begin? Our weekly slot where we demystify the back catalogues of some film, music and art's most respected practitioners. This week, we go back in time to the Renaissance and to a sometimes overlooked but widely recognised as one of the great women painters of all times, Artemisia Gentileschi. One of our regular contributors, Jessica Fahey, is here to tell us more about the artist and the works that she suggests we begin with. Let's start with Artemisia Gentileschi herself. Jess, who was she? Mm-hmm.
She was an extraordinary woman, given the time that she lived in and the experiences that she had, as was pretty much the only chance for women at the time to become artists. Her father, Orazio Gentileschi, was an artist. Some people might know a work by him, of David and Goliath, that's in the National Gallery in Dublin. Mm. And she trained with him from a young age, along with her brothers. But even by the time she's 17, her father says that she's by far the best of them, and in fact challenges other artists to say that she's the best of anyone at that period. So she then follows in his footsteps, essentially becoming a professional artist at a time when that really just wasn't a profession open to women.
I was going to ask you precisely that. She was born in 1593 and then, I suppose, into the 1600s when she was actually working as a professional artist. How unusual was it for a woman to make it into the professional ranks? I mean, was she alone? Were there a few others there?
There were a few others before her. So, for example, in the 16th century, you would have people like Sofonisba Agnesola, but she was a kind of court painter who, you know, worked for the Spanish court, although she was Italian. So she didn't need to run a workshop and to sort of seek out employment. There was also Lavinia Fontana, who is just a little bit older than Artemisia Gentileschi. And she actually had become a full member of the Academy in Rome, the Academy of San Luca in Rome. So there was a little bit of precedent, but it was still extraordinarily unusual for a woman to do so. And Artemisia is kind of, from the letters that we have only very recently discovered, you know, she's out there, you know, selling her talents in letters and saying that she can, you know, prove what a woman can do, and, you know, really quite different in terms of the route that she takes and the type of sort of hard slog essentially that exists within her career.
Let's look then at a few specific works and what it was that, mm-hmm. that she actually did that makes her stand out as a painter just in her own right. The one that you've chosen as our starting point has a rather cumbersome title, it has to be said, Self-Portrait as the Allegory of Painting. Maybe mm-hmm. explain what we're looking at in the painting first of all, and then we come back to that title.
Absolutely. So what we're looking at is a painting of a woman painting, which in itself, as we've already noted, is unusual enough. But the subject of painting as an allegory, so if you were to symbolise the idea of painting within an artwork, it was usually a woman who was used, because it was essentially female figures tend to be used as representations of muses. So it wouldn't be that entirely unusual. But the difference here, of course, is that it may actually, possibly anyway, be a self-portrait. But she's at quite a surprising angle to us. So she's kind of diagonally positioned across the picture space, leaning her head towards us, and she fills up the picture space. So it's a really dramatic pose, presumably because she's showing us with the brush in her right hand. She's using a series of mirrors, they believe, to try and figure out how to paint yourself in such an unusual angle. And even the painting of herself in this unusual angle is kind of showing off as well. You know, it's saying that I can do this, you know, kind of extreme foreshortening and this dramatic and unusual pose. But on top of that, she's also added in a kind of intellectual aspect by, you know, using her knowledge of iconography, and she's including symbols like having her hair very messy and wearing a little gold chain that has imitation, or well, it has a mask on it, but it's a symbol of imitation around her neck, showing that she is aware of texts on iconography, like the famous one by Rupa, which would have been published around the time that her father was painting or started painting. So she's showing, you know, artistic skill as well as this intellectual knowledge of how to forward, you know, symbols in paintings and understand their meaning.
Okay, you're breaking up just a little bit there, but we'll bear with it for the time. No, it's not your fault. It's just something that's happening with the technology.
I live in Wicklow in the mountains, so it can be sometimes the mountains' fault. Yeah,
have those mountains moved immediately, please. You mentioned her father there, Jess, a contemporary of Caravaggio. Now, the painting that we've just spoken about from Artemisia, it's such a personal painting, in fact, in many ways. It has all of those intellectual aspects that you spoke about, you know, a painting of a painting of a woman painting a woman, all sorts of meta things going on there. But biblical themes, given that the father was a contemporary of Caravaggio and given, I suppose, the fashion of painting at that time, biblical themes would have been hugely important. Were they important for father and daughter?
Yes. So we're looking at Counter-Reformation Rome, essentially. So she's born in Rome when her father's an artist there. And it's after the Reformation, after the Council of Trent, where they very specifically lay out the rules of what art should be after the protest from the Protestants and the Reformation. So it's a very important time for painting as the visual example of the reinvigoration of the Catholic Church, but it has to be a certain way. So it has to be direct, and it has to essentially move the emotions of the viewers. So she absolutely falls into that category, as did her father, although arguably he leans more to a kind of cooler, perhaps more idealized classicism, and she leans more into following the dramatic naturalism of Caravaggio. So she's a closer follower of Caravaggio, even though her father actually was his direct contemporary. And some of her works, in fact, were given to Caravaggio until as late as 1995, when they discover her signature after cleaning and then realise, oh, it's not by Caravaggio, it's by Artemisia Gentileschi. Yeah.
And I suppose possibly her best known painting, which is about a horrific event, obviously, Artemisia Gentileschi, Judith beheading Holofernes.
So there's more than one version, as is common actually with her painting. So there tends to be more than one version, but the more famous one is the one in the Uffizi in Florence, which she actually gifted to the Grand Duke Cosimo II of Florence, although she was a bit like Caravaggio, in debt and on the run when she left Florence. So not the greatest way to leave a city, but she left her legacy there. And this painting is subject to the Caravaggio himself had painted, and it's very possible that she knew the painting, or certainly would have known of it through her father. And the scene is Judith, who was a widow from Judea, and her small town was being invaded by the Assyrians. So she decides to take matters into her own hands, and she seduces Holofernes, the leader of the Assyrians, and after getting drunk, cuts off his head. So the subject had been a popular enough one, but usually, say, for example, with sculptor Donatello in the Renaissance, you'd have Judith holding the head of Holofernes, whereas in the Baroque period, where it's all about drama and that moving of the emotions, they show the actual decapitation moment, which is what Caravaggio does. But in her example, what's striking about it is that she really thinks about the strength needed to do the actual deed. So her work arguably is more savage and more powerful. And her composition actually is more striking because it's vertically composed rather than horizontally. So we get all of the scene happening.
Yeah, the head is facing, he's lying down on a bed or on a sofa, on a couch of some kind, and we see the head is facing us as it's taken from the body. But people have theorized, because it's a pretty gory and gruesome image. There are a lot of theories around the visceral nature of the painting and theories around whether or not it was connected to a terrible event in Gentileschi's own life.
Yes. So people have sort of put forward the idea that the head that she's cutting off may well be the head of a man called Agostino Tassi, who had been employed by her father to help improve her painting skills because he was an excellent landscape painter. He, in fact, had been put to court by her father for taking her virginity. So the court case that ensued in 1612 was all about this idea that he had somehow ruined Orazio Gentileschi's property, i.e. his daughter. And he had, in fact, raped her when she was 17 years old. The court case had her tortured. So she was tortured with rope wrapped around her fingers, so they called it still a thumbscrew. He wasn't tortured. Her rapist, and in fact, even though he was found guilty, he was allowed to go free. He was never forced to carry out his punishment. So there is a desire, I think, for many people to see these paintings by her as this kind of revenge, not just against this one individual man, but essentially against that kind of system that failed her. And she was left with that notoriety as well, which you can imagine in the 17th century as a woman, that this wasn't something you could easily get over. So these violent scenes, and there are many of them, not just of Judith and Holofernes, but she painted quite a lot of women killing or grievously wounding men, leads us to at least hypothesize that maybe that's why.
Briefly and finally then, Jessica Fahey, outside of her obviously the father we've heard about there, but her own life outside of her painting, do we know much about her personal life, her personal situation?
Much more recently. So around 2011, a series of letters were found that she wrote when she lived in Florence with her husband. The marriage was an arranged one that was actually arranged even before the court case was finished. So again, this was sort of to try and protect her. And they lived relatively happily together in Florence, had one surviving child. But we found out through these letters that she was also having an affair with a very wealthy Florentine man. And she would write the love letter on one side of the letter, and her husband would write a separate business note to the same man on the other side of the letter. So a very open and progressive couple. And then from there, she went from strength to strength. She moved to Rome. She worked there for a while before going also to Venice. She was in London in 1639 and then back to Naples, where she had a large workshop and finally got to paint public commissions, which was particularly important for artists.
All right,
then.
A whole new meaning to printing on two sides of the page, doesn't it? That's Jessica Fahey there speaking to us about Artemisia Gentileschi, and that is our lot for this Thursday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator at Paddy Carney, was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.